My name is Jerry, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Jerry.
I don't know whether you can tell that or not. I absolutely refuse to not have fun. Let me get all this stuff off me. Now, maybe I won't sneeze into the microphone. I've been sneezing ever since I had those feathers around my neck. I'm probably going to have to sit down in just a few minutes because my left leg last night kept telling me, said, "Jerry, sit down, sit down, sit down." And I said, "I've got 39 years sobriety." And it said, "But I've only got 2 months sobriety." But I've had all kinds of parts replaced in the past year. I've had a new shoulder, complete shoulder replacement, and both knees replaced. I've got one more shoulder to go. And then they'll never be able to get on an airplane. Getting down to serious business, though. Let me see if I can get this to where I can sit and talk at the same time. I don't think I've ever done that. I think that'll do it. Now, can you see me?
Yeah.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Okay, and that leg says, "Oh, thank you, thank you." I was born in a little town of 70,000 people called Atlanta, Georgia. Actually, the population was 70,000 when I was born. And you people who are from Atlanta, have you seen the Fox Theater? On Christmas Day in 1929, my mother was a dancer, and she opened the Fox Theater. And I'm the result of the party afterwards. I was born on September the 21st, 9 months later. So I came into this world floating on alcohol, even though I didn't really have a family that my mother and father, neither one, were alcoholics. And I had a few aunts and uncles and everything that were alcoholics, but not my parents. And my grandmother said, you know, that there never has been any alcoholics in her family. And I said, "Well, what did your father die of?" And she said, "Well, he drank too much." But he didn't die of alcoholism. He had been gone for about 3 or 4 days drinking, and he went up on the roof to fix the roof, and he had a seizure, and he died of seizures. He fell off the roof. So, you know, everybody denies it. It's a denial thing. I really had quite a boring childhood, because I was an only child. And I'd get up on Christmas Day and look at all my presents. And then what? Then it was 15 minutes later. Wasn't anybody to play with. Now that sounds crazy. But it was pretty boring. And there wasn't any TV. We had radios, but there was no TV. And, you know, the adult had a lot of fun, and I certainly started realizing that they were drinking this stuff. And I think at about 8 or 9 years old, I started drinking too. It was in the middle of the Depression. We lived in Buckhead, when Buckhead was way out, way out the country, you know. My father had a bunch of peach trees, and he couldn't sell the peaches off of them. So he and several of the policemen in town went to our basement and peeled peaches and cured them and everything and made peach brandy in our basement. You could smell it for 2 blocks away. And the kids in the neighborhood and myself used to go down and tap the kegs. That's when I really started drinking. And then later on, I fell and broke my jaw, and I discovered pills. And they couldn't understand why, you know, it wasn't healing any better than it was, because I was just having so much pain. And I milked that for about 9 months with the pain, and the doctor finally said, you know, forget it. But I had all kinds of painkillers at that time. And my father was transferred to New York City when I was going into high school. And he found out later, he didn't want to go. And they said, either go or go to jail. And he thought, maybe New York would be better. Being an old Southerner, though. He found out after the war that he was working on the Manhattan Project. And for you all who are young, that was the atom bomb. And I went to high school and college in New York City and had a ball. It was safe, and it was fun, and it was a lot, you know, just a lot of fun. Now, I don't know how the kids survive, but I just had a ball doing it. We used to go to the movies. They had double features with thermoses full of whiskey sours. You know, nobody thought anything about it. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. And I moved down to Charlotte, North Carolina. I got married and moved to Charlotte, North Carolina. And my husband traveled all the time. And a month after I moved there, I had my first child. And I felt nothing of drinking. And when she was 6 months old, we had decided to have 2 children. You know, that's 1, 2. And when she was 6 months old, I got pregnant, and 3 days later, I broke my leg. And as long as I was pregnant, the leg wouldn't heal. And it was a pretty bad break. And finally, at 6 and a half months, I lost the baby. And at that time, you know, now they can save a 6 and a half month baby, but at that time they couldn't. And the doctor said I'd never be able to walk without crutches or a cane ever in my life. And how many people who are alcoholics are given, you know, you can't do this, and you say, just watch. I had been in the Atlanta Civic Ballet, in the first company that they had, and I realized that you could hold on to it. They didn't have any rehab in those days, and I realized you could hold on to a bar and do ballet dancing, you know, exercises. But it hurt too much. So I talked to a doctor into giving me a shot of morphine every day and going and getting the exercises. Then, after about a month of that, I said, I'm wasting so much time between the time that I get the shot and the time I get to the ballet place. Why don't you just write me a prescription for a kit and an open prescription for morphine? He said, that's a good idea. And so I got hooked on morphine. But in those days, you know, you had several other things. You know, you had paregoric, which is opium, over-the-counter, turpinhydrate and codeine, over-the-counter, 8 grains of codeine per bottle, and you could drink a whole bottle in no time at all, you know. And after a year, I walked into my doctor's office in high heels, and he couldn't believe it. Then I got pregnant again. They told me I probably would never get pregnant. And I had a set of twins. That's two children. But we already had one. So that made three. And, you know, I continued on with my drinking and with my drugging. And, you know, I was putting on a little weight, so I got these little marvelous pills from the doctor, little triangular things, you know. It didn't quite do the job, so he gave me these little black capsules. Then I had trouble sleeping, so... I never did street drugs, but who needs them? I really had fun drinking, up to a point. And I had some trouble with my joints. And so they gave me a new thing called cortisone. And it tore my stomach apart. And I couldn't take pills, and I couldn't drink. But I found out that you could mix that much Baylox and that much gin. And it worked. So I'd go to the drugstore and get a whole, you know, half a case of Maalox. And a half gallon of gin. About this time we moved down to Atlanta, Georgia. And the doctor said that I couldn't drink alcohol or coffee or anything for 3 months. And I thought, how can I do that? So I started drinking hot Tang with my pills. That was the most disgusting thing in the world. I didn't make 3 months. But I started drinking pretty heavily because I had changed doctors. And, you know, my source was down a little bit. And my minister came by one day. And he said, I'd be glad to go with you to an AA meeting if you would like. And I said, oh, I'm just too busy. You're going to have to get somebody else to do your social work. And I meant it. I didn't think there was anything wrong with the way I drank. I was one of these people who who, you know, drank constantly but was never really drunk. You know, I was all the time. And we moved to the other side of Atlanta, and I had a neighbor who was a doctor, and he was an alcoholic, and so I had another source of my pills, which I loved. And I was in an automobile accident that wasn't my fault. I was sitting still when somebody jammed into me and got a real bad whiplash. And we were in the process of moving to New Jersey. And I got put in the hospital up in New Jersey when my husband's grandfather's name was on a plaque in the front of the thing. And, you know, they were giving me codeine. They were giving me a whole half a grain every 4 hours, which is like nothing. And I asked the girl that was in the next bed, I said, "Do you know anybody would bring me a bottle?" I said, "I just am so bored here." And she said, "Oh, yeah, my uncle's an alcoholic. He'll bring you a bottle." So every day he'd bring me a bottle, and I'd give him enough money for two bottles, one for him and one for me. And when I got out, I realized that I was an alcoholic. I think that's when I took my first step. I knew I was an alcoholic, but I didn't think there was any hope, because I figured I was, I figured there was no God. There's absolutely nothing up there, because that was a lot easier to think about than to think that I was on God's shit list. You know, there is no God. That way I can't be on his shit list. By the way, talking about spirituality, I don't know what you have here, more clowns or more nuns. We even have a pregnant nun. Immaculate Conception, I guess. I went on that way, and I didn't have too many pills, because, you know, I didn't have the access to them that I had before in Glen Ridge, New Jersey, which is a bedroom town to New York City. We could see the Empire State Building from our front stoop. And, you know, it's just a nice town. It really was a nice town. Full of drunks, but it's a nice town. And I just, you know, kept thinking, something's got to happen. Something's got to happen. And by that time, my aunt and uncle had died of cancer, and my aunt gave me her son, who was 11 years old at the time. So we added one on the top. And in an alcoholic stupor, I added one on the bottom. And it just, you know, that made five. Now, we had decided to stop at two. Plans change. The youngest one, though, was such a joy, because I didn't have to prove anything. Anyway, I was drinking about 6 quarts of gin a week, and it was real top-notch, coast-to-coast gin. You got it at the A&P for $3.19 a quart. You know, top-shelf drinking. And I had to have a drink about every 3 or 4 hours to keep from going into, you know, seeing things and everything, but I never really was drunk. I had a little few little quirks. I couldn't step off of a curb. I had to walk to the driveway to step off, you know. I woke up one time in the middle of the Brooklyn Tunnel, not knowing where in the world I was. You know what the Brooklyn Tunnel is like. That was scary. Let's see. I had this quirk about not going into a bathroom with the door closed already. And I'd yell at the kids like mad, you know, do not close that door. When you come out, leave it open so people will know it's empty, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I got so disgusted one day, I wouldn't go, you know, I would go out and drive to something else, somewhere else to go to the bathroom rather than open the door. Now that's crazy. I took the door off the bathroom. Solved the problem. We had a terrible time with socks in our house. You know, with four kids wearing socks. The baby wasn't wearing them yet, but four kids were wearing socks. And, or I didn't have the baby yet. And I got so mad one day, I went down to the wholesale area and got 144 pairs of blue socks. That solved another problem in my life. To this day, I haven't got a kid that'll wear a blue sock. But I was pregnant, and the doctor told me that he couldn't be responsible for me or the baby if I didn't stop drinking. And, you know, that bothered me. I didn't mind dying, but I couldn't kill the baby. You know, it just, I had one that had died, and I just couldn't do it. I didn't know what to do. And I woke up about 6 o'clock one morning and came downstairs to get my gin, which, you know, I had some like at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning and then 6 o'clock in the morning. And I just put it down and I said, God, help me. I didn't believe in God, but I said, God, help me. Those three magic words. And I went back upstairs, and I got upstairs, and the phone was ringing. And this friend of mine, who was the bass drummer, her husband was a bass drummer in my husband's bagpipe band. And he, you talk about a hangover in bagpipes? Torture. And she said that her son had cut his hand, and could I take care of her other three kids while she took them to the hospital? And she was pregnant, and I was pregnant. She had four kids, and I had four kids. So she dumped them by, and they all ran in, and I put them all in front of the TV, and all seven of them. And I went in the kitchen and just sat there, because I didn't know what to do. I was really, I couldn't do it. And finally she came back, and her son didn't have any real damage in his hand. He sewed it up, you know, and it wasn't really damaged. And she looked over at me. She said, do you have anything to drink? And I said, yeah, we've got some beer and we got some scotch. I didn't tell her about my gin. And she said, that's fine. And so she poured herself about that much scotch and got a can of beer. And she looked over at me, and I was, you know, where you just about are shaking, you know. You keep looking at your hands to see if they're shaking or not. And she looked at me and she said, "What's wrong with you?" And I said, "I think I got a virus or something, but I haven't been around the kids." She said, "A virus? Hell, how much have you had to drink?" And I said, "Well, I got enough until the A&P opens up." And she said, "Well, I'm an alcoholic. Would you like to go to a meeting with me?" And I looked at her, and she was pregnant, had her nightgown stuffed into a pair of blue jeans and her husband's raincoat over the whole thing with blood dripping down it, drinking a Boilermaker at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I thought, well, if they'll take her, they'll take me. There was hope. So the next day we went to our first AA meeting on St. Patty's Day, 1963. And I stopped drinking, but I didn't stop any drugs because nobody knew then, you know. Nobody knew about it. If there were prescription drugs, they were okay because the MDity gave them to you, right? And she had an uncle who was an MD, and she'd come over with these bags of samples, my sponsor would, and we'd go through them with a PDR, and, you know, if you laid it on the table and it didn't crawl away, we took it. And I went on like that for several months. I had the baby. The baby was born, and as soon as he'd wake up, he'd scream and cry and turn blue. And they called in a pediatric psychiatrist. And the pediatric psychiatrist said he just had a mother urge, and that whenever he woke up, they were to immediately bring him to me and let him nurse. Well, the guy was getting his fix, is what he was doing. He was addicted to drugs. He was getting his fix. It wasn't until many years later that I realized he had a pointed head. His teeth came in and there were little tiny teeth. He had a hip that was wasn't formed right, in a club foot. And I was in the Yale School on Alcoholism, and they were teaching us about alcoholic babies, and I realized that he was one. He was. And nobody knew it. Well, I went on for months doing, you know, whatever I could to try to do the AA group thing. My home group was 52 World War II veterans and two pregnant women. And you've never seen so many nervous men in your life. I got even with them, though. They used to stand up and give talks, and they'd talk about how wonderful it was to drink, and then I joined AA and lived happily ever after. And they'd sit down. I went into labor at a meeting. One guy almost fainted. But I started going to church and Sunday school and Bible study and, you know, everything I could think of. And it wasn't working. I wasn't getting sober. I could look at other people and tell that they were getting sober and I wasn't. And I was still as crazy as I ever was. But nobody ever said, "Don't take pills." Nobody said it. And the interesting thing was my sponsor's father was in the program, and his sponsor was Bill W. And, you know, they didn't say a word about it. Nobody said anything about it. And I decided I was one of the rarelys. You know, rarely have you seen someone fail. So I decided that I would make like I was real drunk for about 3 or 4 days and then kill myself. And everybody would think it was an accident. And I planned it all out to where the kids went back to school on January 6th. I had it all absolutely, you know, made out where nobody got any guilt or anything like that. And I had them go to somewhere else for after school, and I had somebody taking care of the baby, and I took enough pills to kill a horse. And I sat there with the sun shining in on me. It was a winter day, but the sun was shining in. I had the storm door closed, but the regular door open, waiting to die. Well, my Sunday school teacher all of a sudden got the urge. By the way, don't try suicide. It just doesn't work. And, you know, my Sunday school teacher left work and came to see me. She had never done anything like that. And she recognized what happened. And she called the ambulance and was put in the hospital. And for days I had tubes coming out of me, and they didn't know whether I was going to live or die. And it was a hard thing because it really affected my brain. My brain is still affected. I went to a high school where they had French nuns at the high school, and we had to speak French at lunch 3 days a week and Latin at lunch 2 days a week. And I lost the ability to speak both languages. Except I was over in Paris one day, and I was in the subway that they have there, and I looked over on the wall, and it said, these seats reserved for maimed war veterans first, war veterans second, and pregnant women third. And I thought, that's nice. I thought, why'd they put it in English? I realized that I had lost the trigger for the French and not the French. And somebody could walk up to me and speak in French and I would speak back, you know. But I could not do it voluntarily. I lost the ability to read little words, little tiny words, like the, cat, dog, at, that. I could read the big ones, but I couldn't read the little ones. I had the twins in the first grade, and they taught me how to read. And it took me several months before I could read anything. I went from the hospital over to a treatment center. In those days, they didn't have treatment centers. They had one in Connecticut and one in New York City and one out in New Jersey, called Little Hill Alena Lodge. And I went there, and the woman who ran it was Geraldine O. Delaney, and she signed everything G-O-D with her initials. She saved my life because she had been addicted to pills, and she knew what it was all about. And she had worked in the medical profession for years. And I got off of pills. And that's when I, you know, my sobriety date is January 6th, 1964. Now, how many of you were born after 1964? That's great. Mere children. for you all old ladies. I got an email this week, and it has just tickled me. It seems that this husband and wife woke up in bed one morning, and he snuggled up to her and said, you know, just snuggle. And she said, don't touch me. And he said, why not, honey? And she said, don't touch me. I'm dead. And he said, no, you're not dead. You're talking to me. And he said, she said, well, I must be dead. I woke up and I don't hurt anywhere. But I had a struggle the first while. A lot of the AA people didn't work the steps. I don't know how they stayed sober, but they didn't work the steps. Geraldine O'Delaney worked the steps, and people around her did. I twisted off buttons. Every button I had, I would twist it off and eat it. They took bets in my home group whether I'd make it or not. They lost. They had only about 25% of them thought I was going to make it. And when I had my first birthday, they call them anniversaries up there, they gave me a cake with buttons on it and a package of buttons. I needed to have a place on Monday morning, on Mondays, to go to meetings. And I needed women. And so I passed the word around that I was going to be sitting in my living room at 1 o'clock on Mondays, put the baby down at 12:30, be sitting there at 1 o'clock, and anybody would like to join me for a meeting to come. The first meeting, we had almost 50 people there. 50 women. Some of them had driven over 100 miles to get there. And it wasn't that popular later on, but we would have between 10, 15, 20 people there every week. Finally, the little one got obnoxious and wouldn't take a nap, so we had to move to a church. And when I celebrated my 10th birthday, they gave me a ring with the AA emblem that they use up there. And it had a G on the top, an AA on the bottom, and a dot in the middle. And if you keep yourself, you are the dot. If you keep yourself surrounded by God and AA, you'll be okay. Isn't that nice? Mm-hmm. But I went on. My husband was an alcoholic. By the way, when I brought that baby home from the hospital, he had 2 bagpipe bands and a keg of beer sitting on the kitchen table. And I took one look at it and went to an AA meeting. So my youngest one was 6 days old when he went to his first meeting. And it was a weird meeting in Montclair, to where the women all sat on one side and the men all sat on the other. And 99% of the women sitting on that side were Al-Anon. And I just walked in and handed the first Al-Anon the baby. They loved it. And my kids went to meetings with me, because if they hadn't have, I wouldn't have gotten sober. Because I couldn't get a babysitter, you know. And they went to meetings. Had a great big old guy, and I finally changed meetings. And I went to an interracial group in Montclair. And this big guy named Quint, he was 6'9 and weighed 350. enormous thing. And when anybody would speak, he'd say, "That's okay, baby." You know, it was like a church meeting or something.
"Tell it like it is, baby."
And he'd line the kids up in the back of the room, and he'd say, "Do your homework and shut up." Had no trouble with them. And, you know, life is funny because my husband was an alcoholic, and he was also a womanizer, and, you know, I kept thinking, well, you know, things are going to change, because I went to Al-Anon, and I got sober, you know, and he's going to change. He didn't, ever. By the way, he died of stubbornness. He had colon cancer and wouldn't go to the doctor until about 3 weeks before he died. So I say that he died of stubbornness. And they didn't get him in the hospital until he passed out. But he was a bra Scot, good looking, and I was crazy about him, addicted to him. I loved him with every pore of my body. And, you know, and he got just absolutely terrible. He decided he was the head of the household, and he became very emotionally abusive, and not physically abusive, but very emotionally abusive. He would put a lock on my car. He would lock the steering wheel because he didn't want me to go anywhere. I got a phone call one day, and he said, "You know, I don't want you getting phone calls." He just pulled the phone out of the wall. He had to have the supper on the table at 6 o'clock. And if I got it on the table at 6:10, everybody had to sit there until 6 o'clock before they could eat, because he said it was to be ready at 6. And he was very emotionally, and I became extremely depressed. I mean, really extremely depressed. And my best friend, who I had sponsored for a while, and then she became a very close friend, and my husband put me in a mental hospital. And the doctor that interviewed me could barely speak English, and she said, "Have you tried to commit suicide?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Would you do it again the same way?" And I said, "No, because that didn't work." And she said, "How would you do it?" And I said, "I would take a gun and put it in my mouth and shoot." She said, "Do you own a gun?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Take this lady to section such and such." That was the crazy crazies. So I went there, and about 3 days later, it scared me, the shit out of me, you know. Those people are, one of them tried to choke me in the middle of the night and everything. And even though there was there was somebody guarding us all the time, supposedly, and the head of it saw me, and he said, "Jerry, what are you doing here?" And I told him, and he put me in the treatment area. And I was examined by several psychiatrists and everything, and they decided I had reaction depression. And they said that if you don't leave your husband, you'll be dead in 6 months. So I decided to leave him, and I decided to go down to the Keys, where my father had a condominium. You know, poor baby. And I got down there, and about 3 days later, which was New Year's Eve, I got a phone call from my husband first, and then a few minutes later from my psychiatrist. And he said that my husband said that my best friend Beverly was dead. And I thought, you know, what happened? And then the psychiatrist called me. He had had a hard time finding out where I was. And he said that she had called him to tell him she was committing suicide because she thought I had left my husband because I so dearly, my best friend and my husband betrayed me. And I, to this day, I don't know how I didn't drink. It was purely the grace of God. Absolutely the grace of God. And I called AA and I said, I've got to talk to somebody. And somebody called me and we talked for about 2 hours. And then I was okay. And 3 or 4 days later, I went over to her house and met her husband. And I had known him in New Jersey with his former wife. And I told her, I said, you got to get rid of that son of a bitch. He's no good for you. And she said, I was just thinking the same thing. So she went out a couple of days later and got a divorce. But we became good friends down there. And I moved back to Atlanta because my mother was very sick. And I really, you know, didn't move here. We didn't want to move here, but I really enjoyed it when I was here. I started going to NABA, and I was sitting in the downstairs one day, and this woman came in, and she said, if I could only get to a meeting at 5:30, it would be great. And I looked at my friend Peggy Riggs, and I said, let's have a meeting. So we started a meeting at 5:30 at NABA. And it was once a week on Thursdays. Now I think they meet every night, 5:30. And, you know, I went to, I lived in Roswell and went to the one on Roswell Road of, you know, what it was, 2711 or? 8111. 8111, yeah, uh-huh. And had a key to that club, and they had a shaky beginning because they got the place because somebody had killed themselves in it. They couldn't sell it. That's little knowledge that very few people know. And I was having fun and enjoying life. I absolutely refused to be sad. I enjoyed life. And my husband started writing me. And he said that he, you know, had been going to a psychiatrist and that he had changed and he wasn't going in any more drunken binges and he wasn't womanizing anymore. And would I please come back to him? And, you know, alcoholic thinking, I did. And we had a wonderful time for about 3 years. And then his psychiatrist died and he had permission to do everything he did before. So I knew that he was, you know how you, they say that a frog sits in water and they turn the water up and it starts boiling and it just keeps boiling and boiling until he boils to death. You know, I kept sitting in that situation. I knew he was drinking. I knew he had girlfriends. I knew everything, you know. But I could not leave him. And I had my grandchildren, a couple of grandchildren up in New Jersey, and I took them back down to Tennessee, and I turned right around and went back up to New Jersey. again. And he said, stay down there for a couple of weeks, enjoy yourself. And I said, no, I'll come on back. And I walked in, and he had his girlfriend in my bed. That was it. You know, that was the grace of God. Because that was it. And I decided to leave him. Well, you know, I called up where I had my money market. My father had left me some money, and I had a money market account. And I said, please transfer, you know, a certain amount to my account. And he said, that account is closed. We transferred everything. He had transferred everything to a joint account, and I had nothing. And not only that, but he had given his girlfriends most of my jewelry. And I just, you know, I came to Tennessee, and it's the best thing I've ever done. And I tried to get him to divorce me, and he wouldn't. And I tried everything. You know, I said, all you have to do is sign the papers. No, he wouldn't do it. And finally, his mother came to see me right away. And my daughter said, why don't you come and stay with us? Because there's a lot more room in our houses. And she said, I'm not here for a visit. I'm here to make a statement. She said, I'm here to visit my daughter, Jerry. I'm never setting foot in Bruce's house as long as he lives. And she didn't. She said, that is just unacceptable behavior. And she and I were good friends as long as she lived. And, you know, that was nice. And I lived in Tennessee, and I've lived there since 88. And finally, one day, she was visiting me, and she said, why won't you give Bruce a divorce? And I said, what do you mean? I've even been to a lawyer and gotten all the papers and everything, and he won't divorce me. And she said, Within about 2 weeks, I got papers from his lawyer. 2 weeks after it was final, he married his girlfriend. But it was a blessing for me. People wanted me to tell you this story, which happened 4 years ago, but I think it's neat. And by the way, I'm running over, aren't I? They told me to keep it to 40 minutes. That's 73 years and 40 minutes. That's like 30 seconds a year. Can't be done. But I was with a group that was studying the Sermon on the Mount. And it came to the point where they said, if you don't have what you need to tell God of your needs. That's pretty simple, isn't it? So I stood up and I said, God, I need a Lexus. And she said, the girl that was running it said, Jerry, you're supposed to pray for spiritual things. And I said, I can get awful spiritual in a Lexus. And I said, and I have a real need. I've got this little silica that's got 230,000 miles on it, and I can't hardly get in and out of it. God knows I need a Lexus. So the next day in the mail came my bank statement. And the United States government had put $10,370 in my account. Look at her laugh. So I went up to the Social Security office and I said, can I keep it, or did you make a mistake? And she punched all kinds of buttons, and she said, no, your husband's second wife applied for his benefits, but she hadn't been married to him long enough. Not only that, but we're going to be putting $500 a month in your account. And extra. And I said, it sounds like a Lexus to me. So I went out the next day and bought a Lexus. My payments are $497 a month. I make $3 on the deal. And I love it. It's a great car. It's just what I needed, and God knew I needed it, you know. So if you need something badly, don't be afraid to tell God you need it. You know, that's basic. Mm-hmm. You know, we forget about these basic things. We think, you know, everything has to be spiritual. And that's right. Everything is spiritual. Everything. Everything you do is spiritual. You know, the old saying about you have to say a blessing before you eat. The way that got started is people asked God's permission to eat the food because there was so much bad food. And God would either give them permission or not give them permission. And that's how they lived a long time. So everything you do is spiritual. Brushing your teeth is spiritual. And you can make it even more spiritual if you connect brushing your teeth with praying for somebody that you don't like. Like a mother-in-law. And every time you brush your teeth, pray for somebody you don't like. God to bless them. And it helps. Helps your spirituality. It really does. You know, we're so stubborn. We're stubborn alcoholics. You know, anybody ever heard of the 23rd Psalm? When you read it, just think about it. He leadeth me beside the still waters. I mean, you're not going to go by the still waters by yourself. He's got to lead you there. He maketh me to lay down in the valley, in the green pastures. He makes me to lay down and be still and know that he is God. We're not going to do it by ourselves. God makes us do these things. And it's in the Bible where he makes us do these things. But he gives you promises too. Through the valley of the shadow of death, you'll fear no evil. And I'm a testimony to that because of these three operations. Because I went through the valley of the shadow of death, which I took painkillers because you can't not take them. And it didn't affect me at all. I didn't get high or anything. You know, I would take them and it would stop the pain. But it didn't give me the treat I wanted. And when I stopped them, I didn't have any withdrawals. Now that's crazy, isn't it? That's God's miracle. Through the valley of the shadow of death, and for an alcoholic drug addict like me, that was the valley of the shadow of death. And my God and your God and everybody's God took me through, and I thank him for it.
And thank you all for listening to me.